Now in its 10th season, Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a podcast about tragedy, triumph, unequal justice, and actual innocence. Based on the files of the lawyers who represent them, together with other criminal justice activists and experts, Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom features interviews with men and women who have spent years in prison for crimes they did not commit, some of them having even been sentenced to death. These are their stories. Look for Wrongful Conviction podcasts wherever you listen to podcasts.
As we start to think about our post-pandemic future, some say it's time for bold action, time to think about a greener global economy.
Europe is in a unique position to be able to invest in a collective recovery and a common future.
As places start to open up, one indigenous group off the coast of British Columbia is not ready to let visitors return. At one time, its population was in the thousands. Now the native community is only about 500 people.
So we can't afford to lose anybody. Our only defense on the island here is just not to get this virus on the island.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, discovering a long-lost film in Spain.
No sabemos si es aquí cuando desaparece Mallorca, por así decir.
Mallorca from the early 1930s, the first film directed by a woman in Spanish history. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you here. Washington is far from alone. Governments everywhere are trying to figure out how to put together a recovery plan to get past the economic blow from this pandemic. The European Union today moved forward on its plan. In one sense, it's similar to Washington's approach. The price tag is enormous. The EU is proposing $825 billion worth of new spending. If that amount is approved, it would add up to $2 trillion in recovery money for Europe. The U.S. is also dealing in the trillions when it comes to recovery, but there's a big difference. As the Trump administration has moved to help save oil companies and dump more environmental regulations, the EU is making a greener future the priority in its post-pandemic recovery plans. The World's Carolyn Beeler starts us off today.
The European Commission is calling its new recovery package Next Generation EU. Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the pandemic provides an opportunity to re-envision the future.
I want us to take a new, bold step together. Europe is in a unique position to be able to invest in a collective recovery and a common future.
Reversing the post-pandemic economic crisis will require solidarity, she said, while announcing the plan at an EU meeting in Brussels.
And while we are doing this, we need to press fast forward towards a green, a digital, and a resilient future, because this is the future of Europe's next generation.
The EU budget is required to dedicate a quarter of its funds to climate-friendly projects, and the recovery package is no exception. It also earmarks 30 billion euros to aid the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, and it includes a do-no-harm clause that would rule out spending on fossil fuels. Other spending details are scarce. But Finnish Environment Minister Krista Mikkonen is satisfied that green development is a priority.
I'm very happy that it's there very strongly.
The recovery package promises a wave of energy-efficient renovations, investments in hydrogen energy, and installation of 1 million electric vehicle charging stations across Europe.
That's what we need when we are solving one crisis. We need to solve the other crises at the same time, the crisis with the climate change and overconsumption.
Joel Jaeger from the nonprofit World Resources Institute has been tracking pandemic recovery packages around the world and says this is the most ambitious when it comes to climate change.
The EU investments that are proposed for green measures are really an order of magnitude larger than what any other countries have been doing so far.
Indonesia, he says, is planning a solar energy subsidy program as part of its recovery plan.
South Korea's increased its renewable energy subsidy for rooftop solar. Denmark has invested more than $4 billion in green renovations to social housing. But really, none of them are nearly as large as this proposed package.
Manon Dufaux is head of the Brussels office of the European environment think tank E3G. She says the priority placed on energy-efficient renovations is a textbook example of a stimulus project that's good both for the environment and for citizens who struggle to pay for heat and electricity.
It's an investment in infrastructure, in making Europe more resilient, but it also has a very strong social component.
The recovery plan has to be approved by all 27 member states of the EU, and that is likely to be a slog. The COVID-19 crisis has divided Europe along familiar lines. Southern European countries like Italy and Spain have been especially hard hit by the pandemic and the resulting economic fallout, while some of the northern European countries that have fared better are already protesting the price tag of the recovery. The so-called Frugal Four, Austria, the Netherlands, Denmark, and Sweden, are among them. And this worries Esther de Lange, a representative of the Netherlands who spoke at the EU meeting today.
If you propose making this a matter of 23 against 4, we won't succeed. You will push those four countries in the arms of the extreme right if you say, let's do this without unanimity.
Manon Dufaux of the environmental think tank expects some very heated debates.
The negotiations that will follow will be a true test, not only of European unity, but also on the European commitment to climate neutrality.
Expect those negotiations to last a while. Leaders will start hashing out the recovery package at a summit in June, and they don't expect this stream of recovery funds to start flowing until the beginning of next year. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Iran is holding a number of foreigners in detention, and the government there is sending mixed signals about what comes next for those detainees. There's been some talk of a mass release, but at the same time, Iran's courts have been handing down convictions and long sentences. It's not known exactly how many Westerners are detained in Iran. Many families prefer not to publicize their cases, but it's probably a few dozen. 66-year-old Anousheh Ashouri is among them. Ashouri is British-Iranian, a retired engineer. He's been in jail in Tehran for 3 years of a 10-year sentence on spying charges. I spoke today with his wife, Sherry Izadi, in London about how he's coping right now.
Physically, he has adapted. I mean, initially, he wasn't doing very well during the first year when he was in solitary confinement for a long time. And he was under interrogation for up to 10 or 12 hours a day for several months. He went on a hunger strike and he had a couple of suicide attempts. But, I mean, fortunately, he's put all that behind. And I think he's now focused on keeping mentally and physically fit enough to survive this and to come out.
Where does your husband's case stand currently?
Oh, he's been convicted and his appeal was rejected. So at the moment, his sentence is firmly in place. And other than an agreement being reached between the British government and the Iranian government over the state of these detainees, we don't have any legal recourses left to us, really.
We're hearing perhaps encouraging news that Iran is perhaps looking for ways to release these prisoners. You follow the signals regarding possible releases and exchanges. What are you hearing?
Well, I mean, with the outbreak of COVID-19 in Iran, there was a lot of hope that because of Iran's need for foreign aid and the request it actually made to the IMF for a $5 billion loan, we thought that this would be a very good window of opportunity for European states, for the UK or for America to actually come to some sort of a deal with Iran to get these prisoners out. But it seems, honestly, it seems to have been wasted completely. I mean, initially we were very positive, but as time goes by, we haven't seen, you know, any benefits to us or any practical outcomes. So at this moment, I'm not particularly optimistic.
Is it possible Iran is looking for a deal?
It's quite possible. I mean, Iran has sent many open signals to the West that it is ready to, you know, to exchange these prisoners. You know, with each different country, I suppose it depends on what that particular country needs. I mean, the foreign minister, Zarif, he's made repeated overtures to the United States that, you know, Iran is ready to exchange American prisoners with Iranian prisoners. I mean, he's mentioned it openly on the media, you know, on media. But with European governments, it's slightly different. I suppose with some countries, it is looking for prisoner exchange. With others, we believe, particularly the British government, we believe that Iran is looking for the payment of a very old debt that the UK government has to Iran, which is, I think it's about £450 million now.
It's about $600 million.
Yes, we think this is what Iran is seeking at the moment. Iran has proven time and again that they always want something in return for these detainees.
So when might your husband, Anousheh, be released if there is no deal?
Honestly, I mean, his sentence is 10 years. If no deal is reached, we're looking at him spending another 7 years in there. But honestly, that prospect is so terrifying that none of our family has ever actually thought about it. I mean, if every day I think that he's going to spend another 7 years in there and come out a 73-year-old man, I think it will be enough for everyone to have a nervous breakdown.
And Sherry, how are you faring through all of this?
We try to, as a family, we try to keep strong for my husband's sake. I think he's got enough, you know, emotional distress there that we don't want to add to it by appearing that we're suffering or anything. So we always try to put on a brave front for him. But obviously, it's taken its toll on our family. It's not easy. It's not easy to see your family member imprisoned, you know, for no reason whatsoever. He's a very kind, decent man, and when you see someone like that suffer for something that he's, you know, he's completely innocent of, it erodes you away in a way. You know, it's extremely hard.
Sherry Izadi's husband, Anousheh Ashouri, has been in an Iranian jail on spying charges for 3 years. Sherry, thank you very much for speaking with us. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your program.
If you've got to be in quarantine, might as well be in luxury. A 16th century castle in Germany with its own moat and surrounding forest, for example. The Rheinsberg Palace is where members of a Bolivian orchestra were first stranded 2 months ago. The Orquesta Experimental de Instrumentos Nativos, the experimental orchestra of native instruments, arrived in Germany on March 10th to perform at the Merz Music Festival nearby in Berlin. That performance never happened. Germany shut down its borders the same day, and the 25 members of the orchestra were forced into quarantine. The festival organizers managed to let the Bolivians stay on the castle grounds. During the week, the orchestra practices. At other times, they explore the woods of Rheinsberg Palace. Carlos Gutierrez is the orchestra's director, and he spoke to the CBC.
We are close by the castle, but we don't live in the castle. From my window, I have the lake and the woods, and that's great because we can go, of course, not more than two people. We can have a walk.
The Bolivian orchestra has some neighbors on the estate. At least 23 wolf packs make their home there.
Some of the girls from the orchestra, they saw like three wolves that also passed through the path. Of course, it was a shocking encounter and a very interesting experience.
Then there's Frederick the Great, or rather his ghost, who's rumored to walk the halls of his former home. Despite the possible haunting, the group is doing well, but Gutierrez says he doesn't know when they'll be able to return to Bolivia.
We are missing our families, yeah, that's for sure. Even though we have this privilege, we can still make music. But of course, we are very worried about what is happening in Bolivia.
Bolivia has also been impacted by the coronavirus, at least 250 deaths. The Bolivian embassy tells the BBC it's trying to get the orchestra on a flight out of Madrid in early June. You're listening to The World.
The World supporters include Subtitle, a podcast about how we speak.
All of human languages are products of human brains and bodies.
We talk with comedians, politicians, anyone who thinks about language. Alien languages, too.
If I were a sphere with 9 eyes or 9 sensory organs placed around my diameter, how would that affect things?
Subtitle. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Mobile phone apps may hold a promise in the fight against the pandemic. They can help public health officials warn people if they've been exposed to COVID-19. Some countries are trying to get a contact tracing app on everyone's phone, but not all apps are the same. Tate Ryan Mosley is part of a team at MIT Technology Review that compares apps from more than 24 countries around the globe. Tate, thanks for being with us. Give us a quick reminder, if you would, of the technology used, like how a smartphone can actually help with contact tracing.
Yeah, sure. So we're seeing mobile apps using 2 main different types of technologies, GPS, and so your location on your phone, and then Bluetooth signals. If you have a phone with this Bluetooth app enabled and somebody in the same room as you has a phone with Bluetooth enabled, that those Bluetooth signals would actually speak to each other. And then each app logs the encounter with that other, Bluetooth signal.
Mm. And is it generally more reliable than calling people up and essentially interviewing them and relying on their memory of who they've been in contact with?
We don't know yet. The methods are very, very different, and it's not necessarily clear whether digital contact tracing is actually meant to replace manual contact tracing. You know, we're beginning to see that in some of these countries that are doing this well, they really do work hand in hand. So the digital contact tracing is enhancing what the manual contact tracers are doing. But there's just no evidence to say that it's more effective or less effective.
So your database compares the apps, and you're asking specific questions about the data they collect and who the data is shared with, how the data might be used or misused in the future. Can you give us an example of one country's app that your team gives high marks to and why?
Yeah, Singapore's app. It's called Trace Together. It was a very early app, so I think it was released around March 20th. And it was the first Bluetooth system that came online that was really privacy preserving. Basically, all of the data is stored on individual phones, and the Ministry of Health only collects and gathers that data at the point that someone, A, is confirmed to have COVID-19, and then B, consents to the scraping of that data. The data is anonymized, it's encrypted, it doesn't reveal the identity of that person or the other person that might have been exposed, and it's deleted automatically after 21 days. So that was kind of the first gold standard we saw come online.
Mm. So at least Singapore is kind of addressing the privacy issue with Trace Together, their program. What is an example of an app that does not meet your team's standards?
I would say the most obvious one that's getting a lot of press right now is Qatar. So Qatar's app, first of all, it's mandatory. So everybody needs to download this app or you will be, fined or pressed with criminal charges. The app actually requests permission to use the camera and access to the photos on the phone, which they say is, quote, a system requirement, which is just completely unnecessary when it comes to effective digital contact tracing.
That's interesting. So EU countries have privacy built into their laws. How do European apps manage to meet privacy standards and right now still be rigorous about tracing the spread of disease?
Basically, what we've seen with the EU is a series of conversations about how privacy preserving the apps need to be and how rigorous the privacy preserving nature of these apps should be. All of these countries that wanted to go out on their own are being forced into the standards set forth by Google and Apple. And the Google and Apple standards are understood to be more privacy and data preserving, but just the soft power that they're showing alone has been really, really interesting.
So what chance do you see of the U.S. putting out a national contact tracing app? Is that even being talked about or is it in development?
Yeah, so I think in the U.S., we probably won't see a national contact tracing app. I think what we will see is individual states bringing government-sponsored apps on board. My guess is that most of those apps will leverage this Google and Apple infrastructure.
Tate Ryan Mosley is part of a team at MIT Technology Review that compares contact tracing apps from more than 24 countries around the globe. Tate, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Read more about contact tracing and find a link to MIT's tracker at theworld.org. For years, people have been asking for it, and yesterday Twitter responded. For the first time ever, they issued a fact check on a set of tweets from the President of the United States. The unprecedented move is one of several the social media platform has taken against world leaders in recent weeks. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou is following this story. So in these tweets, Lydia, President Trump claimed, with no evidence, that mail-in voting, which more states are doing because of the pandemic, mail-in voting will lead to voter fraud. So if you look at the tweets now, they're flagged, and there's a link below directing people to news articles and information about Trump's claim. This is a really big deal, isn't it?
Absolutely. So for years and years, people criticized Twitter for being too hands-off, for not dealing with false and misleading tweets, especially ones posted by world leaders who have a big following. So flagging tweets by the leader of the free world is a big deal, and it puts Twitter in this position that they and other social media companies have tried to avoid, and that is acting more like a media company, a news organization that fact-checks things rather than a neutral platform.
So what changed? Why is Twitter doing this now?
The short answer is the pandemic. Before that, Twitter wasn't doing this kind of fact-checking. But as you know, there's been so much COVID-19 misinformation that they've been forced to drastically change some of their policies, including fact-checking and labeling misleading tweets. Now, a real challenge for them is going to be applying the rule that they applied to Trump's tweets to the tweets of, you know, all of their 300 plus million users. That's going to be a challenge. But, you know, some people say that this and other actions they've taken against other world leaders is a good first step at clamping down on some misinformation.
Yeah, what about other world leaders and what are we seeing?
So for a while now, Twitter's had this rule saying that if a user like me and you, regular people, post something that could lead to harm, they take it down. But they hadn't been applying that to world leaders. They gave them what's known as a newsworthiness exemption. And the thinking was if a world leader posts something really outrageous or dangerous, that people ought to see that. But the pandemic has changed that. So, for example, when Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro and Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro put out tweets encouraging people not to social distance, promoting fake cures, Twitter took those down because they could lead to death. Some argue President Trump himself has put out tweets that ought to be taken down under the same policy. But so far, Twitter hasn't taken down any of the U.S. president's tweets.
The World's Lydia Emanuelidou. Thanks very much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
We're on Twitter. We're at The World. Another way we can connect, start your morning with a quick hit of the stories from around the globe that we're keeping an eye on. Our team at The World will email it right to your inbox. In this morning's newsletter, for example, we broke down today's commercial space launch and what it means for NASA's dependence on the Russian space program. Start the day with our morning newsletter, Top of the World. Just head to theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's the world, one word, .org/newsletters. I'm Marco Werman. Pro-democracy protesters were back in the streets of Hong Kong today. So were police.
By the afternoon, the police have already arrested more than 300 people, including some students wearing school uniforms.
The beginning of what could be a long, tense summer in the Chinese territory of Hong Kong. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. With a brief announcement today, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo put in jeopardy billions of dollars of trade with Hong Kong. For Pompeo, China's proposed national security law would violate the terms of the One Country, Two Systems agreement between Hong Kong and the mainland. In other words, under that new security law, Hong Kong would lose its autonomy, and under U.S. law, the territory would lose its special trade and economic status. Pompeo said Beijing is making a disastrous decision by imposing a law that undermines freedoms in Hong Kong and China's own promises to the territory. Meanwhile, protesters in the streets of Hong Kong faced off against police, firing pepper pellets at them. Demonstrators are furious over the national security law. They see it as draconian and threatening civil liberties and freedom of speech. Chris Chung is an independent journalist and native Hong Konger. He was watching demonstrations that broke out across the city today.
By the afternoon, the police have already arrested more than 300 people, including some students wearing school uniforms. It's the first day when high school students are going back to school, and the first thing they did was to bring a protest banner back to the school.
There have been reports of some fairly high levels of violence. What did you actually see? What did that look like?
There were reports of fires being started, but mostly when the police came, protesters usually run away pretty quickly and trying to regroup elsewhere. But the police tactic today was a bit different. They don't simply target a certain group of protesters. They were everywhere in Hong Kong trying to prevent road blockade in most of the major areas.
So the Hong Kong police seem to be using a lot more muscle now, bringing more force, and was seen last summer during the months-long demonstrations. Am I right?
It's the difference in tactics. Say in Central, the business area in Hong Kong, the police, when they use pepper pellets on people, it would affect people passing by who had nothing to do with protests. Or they may round up students who are seen doing nothing just to prevent any potential threat.
So this sounds like it's not the outpouring of hundreds of thousands of people that we saw on the streets last summer. Instead, these seem to be much smaller, more spontaneous protests. Do you think this is a new tactic?
The 1 million people, 2 million people march is no longer going to be possible because the police just ban all these gatherings and the governments are using the pandemic situation to impose a law saying that any gathering of more than 8 people on the streets of Hong Kong would be illegal. So they have to be small-scale, scattered, spontaneous protests rather than organized rally, organized marches. And with the national security law upcoming in Hong Kong, protests may be entirely becoming illegal. And the national anthem law today at the parliament in Hong Kong is simply just a small piece of cake compared to national security law.
Right, but without massive demonstrations, the movement in Hong Kong looks weaker. So is it weaker and does it still present a challenge to Beijing?
We have in Hong Kong reached a point of no return when people have visualized so many elements of so-called police violence or government mismanagement, so that people would never really forget the discontent or the unhappiness they faced last year. And I think the process would still go on for months, if not for years, in whatever form it would take.
How much does the coronavirus have to do with the smaller numbers of protesters?
Well, if the government does not have this ban on gatherings, protest organizers would be organizing marches with millions of people every week, if possible. But since it's no longer a legal option, they can't do that and have to find other ways.
So how do you think Beijing is going to proceed with this plan to impose a national security law in Hong Kong? What are the steps you think it will likely take?
It may be passed as soon as next month, or it could be months, or it could be years, depending whether Beijing wants it to be fast or slow.
And how do you think Hong Kongers are going to react when that national security law passes?
Well, I think the Hong Kong people are preparing for this since last year, preparing for the worst case scenario. Some will be continue protesting. Some will be trying to migrate overseas, as a lot of people, young people or young professionals, are preparing to sell the properties and move elsewhere. Overseas Hong Kong people will also try to lobby foreign governments to put pressure on it. So it just put things into progress faster than expected. But China right now does not really care about international pressure or protests in Hong Kong, so that it has decided to use the national security law regardless of protests from foreign countries.
Independent journalist Chris Chung speaking with us from Hong Kong. Thanks very much, Chris.
Thank you.
Lawmakers in Washington have been watching the unrest in Hong Kong. Today, though, the House focused on another troubling situation in China, the attack on the human rights of the Muslim minority Uyghur population. The House voted today and passed the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act. It would sanction Chinese officials involved in forced labor camps in the Chinese province of Xinjiang. An advocacy group, the World Uyghur Congress, has praised the bill, saying it gives great hope. Rahima Mumut is with the World Uyghur Congress. She spoke with us from London.
This is a great moment. It's a history because Uyghur people have been suffering from the CCP oppression.
CCP is the Chinese Communist Party.
Yes, Chinese Communist Party. For the last 3 years, you cannot imagine how we Uyghurs been coping with the situation. Uyghur people in Xinjiang, and also people like myself living in exile. I lost contact with my family since the beginning of 2017. Every day I hear bad news, and I don't know what happened to my family, my sisters, my brothers. And this is the common situation for all the Uyghur people.
I know the World Uyghur Congress has been supportive of the human rights bill before Congress today. For you, what does it actually achieve?
This bill, as I understand, can give a green light to sanction those officials who are responsible for the oppression. That is, for me, it's the first step.
I know a big part of this is about labor and whether forced unpaid labor from Uyghurs in detention camps in Xinjiang is making its way into the supply chains of international companies. What are countries doing to identify that and stop it?
I don't know if any country is really doing anything, but there are NGOs who are working together to try to stop this. For example, we have formed a group called Against Enforced Labor. There are about 11, 12 NGOs. We're working together.
Rahima, as you know, China is facing a lot of international scrutiny right now. There's Hong Kong, which we were just talking about. It's also China's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Does increased pressure over those issues help the Uyghur cause?
I do believe every human rights violation against Hong Kongers, against Chinese people, against anyone should be condemned. I believe the international pressure on China about Hong Kong and also this coronavirus, it actually do help the Uyghurs. The Chinese government is enemy of all the freedom-loving people, whether they are Chinese, the Tibetans, the Hong Kongers, the Taiwanese. And we do hope that all these pressures, sanctions can change the attitude of this very ignorant regime.
Rahima, the oppression of the Uyghur minority in China has been going on for years. The congressional bill is encouraging. What else do you think needs to happen right now?
I believe the second act, the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, I really hope that can be passed soon. Because that is another act that can have some meaningful impacts. For example, that can penalize companies and institutions that have roles in the suppression and is the best way to bring pressure about. And this will hit China's economic prosperity. I believe this is another act that should be passed very soon.
Rahima Mahmood, a human rights activist from the World Uyghur Congress. She's been speaking with us from London. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The transition from emergency lockdown mode into some kind of new normal can be awkward. Some people in remote areas want to remain quarantined for their safety. That's the case in many indigenous communities across the globe. Here's what the world's Rupa Shenoy found out about a few of those communities in northwest Canada.
Off the coast of British Columbia, north of Vancouver, there's a collection of rocky islands covered with mossy rainforest. It's called Haida Gwaii for the people who live there, the Haida Nation. Their economy relies on tourism, and they usually welcome thousands of visitors drawn to world-class fishing and hunting. But this year is different.
Hundreds of people on Haida Gwaii protest and chant as a BC ferry vessel arrives from Prince Rupert.
People on Haida Gwaii are making news for their efforts to keep people out.
Good morning, Council Chambers.
Billy Ivanovich is chief counselor of the Skidigit Band, one of the two bands that make up the Haida Nation. He says there's been no violence at these rallies, just some unpleasantries exchanged.
People were tired of people showing up here, just coming and going at will.
Ivanovich says their frustration is in part rooted in history. The Haida people once numbered in the tens of thousands, but in the early 1900s, they lost 90% to smallpox and other diseases brought by Europeans. Now they number about 500.
So we can't afford to lose anybody. Our only defense on the islands here is just not to get this virus on the island.
In April, a ferry worker staying on one of the islands disclosed he had a roommate on the mainland who had tested positive for COVID-19.
All the communities were upset with this guy. He wasn't doing what he should have been doing, but I think was telling the health officials he was self-isolating. But other people in the communities had seen and witnessed other interaction that he shouldn't have been doing.
The man agreed to leave. No one got sick. But that incident made people on Haida Gwaii realize that if there were an outbreak, their small hospital would be quickly overwhelmed and older people would be most at risk, including the last people fluent in their language.
You know, it's of utmost importance to protect our knowledge keepers because who knows how long we'll have all of them.
Now older people have been confined to their homes. People are bringing them food. The small airlines that service the islands have agreed to cut back flights, and regular big Haida community gatherings have been canceled. Anyone coming in from the mainland has to quarantine for 2 weeks.
It turned us 180 degrees. I think we're quite welcoming people here. Tourism is a big part of our economy. And then to have to say no to visitors at this time is really hard.
The situation got more difficult in late April when British Columbia officials declared hunting and fishing essential services, paving the way for sportsmen to travel. In early May, the president of the Haida Nation, Jason Alsup, told webcast viewers that the province could be doing more to help restrain tourists.
To see people wanting to come to our communities and territories and move around freely is disrespectful and disappointing.
Provincial officials say the Haida have the right to keep people out, but the ferry companies who service the islands told me that they can't stop people from traveling there. They can only point ferry riders to the posted signs that tell people not to come. To actually stop the flow of travelers coming in, the Haida have turned to the nearby coastal First Nations to coordinate strategies and present a unified voice.
It's really brought together the rural communities in a way that really hasn't been seen before.
Marilyn Slett is Coastal First Nations president. She says they've set up checkpoints at all the entrances to their reserves. Community patrols monitor the marinas. Guardian watchmen patrol the borders. And Slett says they do have to turn people back.
Most of them are respectful, some not so much. And we know that people are trying to get away from the large centers and have means and access to their pleasure boats and yachts. But, you know, I think for the most part, they do definitely understand.
Meanwhile, Slett says they've built a surge center and a community gym to supplement their small hospital and hired a contact tracer. Still, they need services like rapid testing before they can even have a conversation about reopening. For her and for Chief Counselor Billy Ivanovich on Haida Gwaii, the lives of those who might be lost to the coronavirus are far more important than the potential damage to their economy by staying closed.
The risk of it hitting here and having such a negative impact on our islands is not worth any dollars we could make by opening up too soon. We'll open things up when we're ready.
When there are no new cases or a vaccine, he says they'll be glad to welcome people back. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Let's talk sports for a couple of minutes. For some of us, being stuck at home but having no live sports to watch on TV has been a little rough. I mean, how many times can you watch those classic Lakers-Celtics championships? There is some professional soccer right now, like Germany's Bundesliga, holding matches, but with no fans in the stadiums. Even on television, it just doesn't feel like the real thing. It's way too quiet. But now there's an app for that.
Remote Cheer, powered by SoundUD, is a system to send support remotely.
That's right, the Remote Cheerer.
By using this application, fans can send their support from their homes directly to the stadium.
Tap one button to cheer, tap another to boo, tap another to send a special insult to your most despised rivals. Huh, how do you say trash talk in German? The app developer says these user-generated sounds can be piped into a stadium sound system.
Depending on the number of people and the number of times the buttons are tapped, the volume and excitement will increase.
Or it could also just be a big crazy mashup of cheers and boos and insults. Still waiting to see where this idea actually takes to the field. With much of the planet under lockdown these past months, we've had a lot more time to rummage through our drawers, our basements, our freezers, taking stock and cleaning up. It's been kind of the same for archivists. In Spain, researchers at the National Film Archive finally had time to sort through some dusty old movies that had been ignored for decades. And one film they came across rewrites a bit of Spanish cinema history. Lucia Benavides has our story.
The 8-minute black and white documentary is a journey across the Spanish island of
Mallorca.
Mallorca.
Cuya belleza fue tantas veces cantada por los poetas.
It starts with the narrator talking about the beauty of the Mediterranean island, one that he says has been captured by poets. It shows snippets of life, kids running down a pedestrian street, a monk grabbing water from a well, fishermen on their boats. Researchers think that the film, titled Mallorca, was made between 1932 and 1934, making it the first talking film directed by a woman in Spain.
And it's really a very beautiful film. It has like a personal quality to it.
Carlos Reviriego is the deputy director at Spain's National Film Archive, Filmoteca Española. He and his colleagues discovered the film this month after they took home digitized copies of archived films that hadn't been properly examined, the kind of work they could do while quarantined at home. The film Mallorca was donated to the archive in 1982 by the owner of a furniture storage business. It was labeled as a silent film directed by a man. So when Reviriego and his colleagues finally watched it, the opening credits took them by surprise. They had never heard of the name Maria Forteza.
And as much as we tried to locate and investigate it, we couldn't find who she was.
Normally, the Filmoteca wouldn't make this kind of discovery public until their investigation was complete. But with the quarantine and lack of access to archival material, they decided to post the film online with hopes that somebody would have information about the mysterious director.
Pues yo soy periodista.
A journalist from Mallorca, Laura Jurado, stepped forward and in just a few days unearthed the director's past.
Pues María Forteza era una cantante.
Jurado says that María Forteza was a singer, specifically a cupletista, a cabaret-style entertainer particular to Spain in the early 20th century. Forteza was well known in her hometown of Mallorca, in part for her fashionable style and for chain-smoking Egyptian cigarettes on stage. Forteza was also married to film producer Ramón Úbeda. In the mid-1930s, the couple left Mallorca for Barcelona, where Úbeda founded a sound production company. But their studio was raided in 1939 by fascist police working under Spanish dictator Francisco Franco, and their entire film collection was confiscated.
No sabemos si es aquí cuando desaparece Mallorca, por así decir.
Jurado says this may be when the film Mallorca disappeared. Mallorca is likely Forteza's only film, says Jurado. It was made to draw tourists to the island a couple of decades before it became a popular holiday destination. But the film never reached the public. That is, until now. And Jurado says it's been huge news in Mallorca. The Spanish archive plans to have a grand premiere at a theater on the island once it's possible.
Porque no se conocían figuras femeninas de directoras tan tempranas ni de casualidad.
We didn't know of any female directors in Mallorca during that time period, she says. Jurado received tips from people all over the island who, under quarantine, had more time on their hands than usual. Carlos Reviriego from Spain's National Film Archive says the film's date has yet to be officially confirmed. But whether or not it really is the first film directed by a Spanish woman is beside the point.
It points out that women have been erased from history, from film history, because there's never been any knowledge about who is María Forteza.
The rediscovered short film doesn't just show the beauty of a tranquil Mediterranean island before getting overrun by tourists. It also reopens a conversation about how little we know of female filmmakers from the time period, since they were largely ignored. For The World, Lucia Benavides, Moya, Spain.
If you're like me, throwing on some soothing music at the end of a long day can provide some relief from these stressful times. And here's where Japanese novelist Haruki Murakami steps in.
Look for the silver lining whenever a cloud appears in the blue.
Murakami, the author of such novels as 1Q84 and A Wild Sheep Chase, was the host of a Tokyo radio special called Music for a Brighter Tomorrow. The coronavirus has all of us feeling down these days, he says. So let's turn to the power of music to see if it can make us feel at least a little better. The author opened his two-hour late-night broadcast with Modern Folk Quartet's song, Look for the Silver Lining.
So always look for the silver lining and try to find the sunny side of life.
Murakami then jumped to Bruce Springsteen's Waiting on a Sunny Day, a song he pointed out that many Americans sang in unity after 9/11. Murakami brought listeners 17 more tracks with lyrics about smiles, sunshine, rainbows, and the belief that things will get better. He spun Nina Simone's version of Here Comes the Sun and Sun is Shining from Bob Marley and the Wailers before slowing things down a bit to play Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head from the Ronald Isley-Burt Bacharach collaboration.
Nothing seems to fit. No, the raindrops keep falling on my head. They keep falling.
Between the melodies, Murakami related the lyrics to his own life. He told the audience about the time he ran a 10-kilometer race with someone who was visually impaired. Murakami said that experience taught him how complaining won't solve anything, something Raindrops reminds us of.
Crying's not for me. No, I'm never gonna stop.
Murakami is 71. He hosted the show from his home with his cat by his side. Murakami is a lifelong music fan. It's a big part of some of his best-selling novels. Murakami even ran a jazz bar in Tokyo after graduating from university. The closer in his coronavirus radio special was this number written and performed by Burt Bacharach, his 1965 hit, What the World Needs Now is Love.
What the world needs now is love.
What the world needs now is masks and a vaccine, but love is no less needed, Murakami told listeners. Is there anything more important than love?
The world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, oh, but just for everyone.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.